Welcome to The Digital Patient, where we discuss the latest advancements in digital patient engagement and share stories from the front lines. I'm your host, Alan Sardana, and with me as always is CMOS-MD co-founder and CEO, Dr. Joshua Liu. Today, we're joined by our very special guest, Dr. David Petrino. Dr. Petrino is a physical therapist with a PhD in neuroscience. He worked as a clinician in Australia before moving to the United States to study computational neuroscience at Harvard Medical School, MIT, and NYU. He has served as a faculty member at Weill Cornell Medicine and Burke Medical Research Institute. He's currently the Director of Rehabilitation Innovation for the Mount Sinai Health System and an Associate Professor of Rehabilitation and Human Performance at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Petrino works to develop innovative technology solutions for individuals in need of better healthcare accessibility. He works with the Red Bull High Performance, the Brooklyn Nets, and the U.S. Olympic team to use evidence-based technology to improve athletic performance. He's also the chief mad scientist of Not Impossible Labs, a group that crowdsources accessible technological solutions for high-impact humanitarian problems. His research has been featured on ABC, Sports Illustrated, The Wall Street Journal, the BBC, Time Magazine, TEDx, Wired, and The New York Times, just to name a few. He's the author of Hacking Health, How to Make Money and Save Lives in the Health Tech World, available on Amazon and Springer Nature. In 2019, Dr. Petrino was named Global Australian of the Year for his contributions to healthcare. Dr. Petrino, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
It honestly is great. We're super excited to have you on the show. You know, David, you have the most incredible perspective on healthcare. You basically grew up in a hospital. You worked as a physical therapist. You left that world behind to earn your fellowship under Dr. Emery Brown, and then launched a lab dedicated to the intersection between new technologies and clinical usage with the faculty position at Mount Sinai. I'm curious, how has your personal journey shaped how you view the role of technology or the role that technology can play in patient-centered care?
Well, I mean, in terms of my own personal journey, I think that growing up in one of the most remote places in the world and understanding how much of a challenge it is to get good quality care in a highly remote place, I can't say that it didn't sort of immediately put to front of mind how important technology could be and how we had to think about things differently, growing up in Western Australia versus growing up in a city like New York, where there are phenomenal hospitals and phenomenal physicians on, you know, every corner of the street. So I do think that that's always been something that has been, you know, a part of something that I've been considering. Even just growing up in Western Australia and growing up in the health ecosystem in Western Australia, we were using telehealth to manage care very, very early on, because it was just practical to do so. And so then to come to a place like the United States and see the level of resistance was actually quite surprising. And that's something that I've noticed across the years, is that in, I'll say, a newer country like Australia, there's a lot of innovation, but it's much harder to, you know, rapidly scale things across the board because everyone's doing their own little thing. Whereas in a place like the US, you can get these big giants that will scale things eventually, but boy, it's hard to like convince them to hit that spot and adopt the new technology across the board.
And David, I guess in terms of, making the move to the US, was that mostly around some of the education you were doing in neuroscience and in particularly computational neuroscience, or was there a different reason that you decided to move on over?
No, definitely the big piece of my move was to go and work with Emery. There is no doubt, I met Emery at a course. He told me he was collecting people from different continents and he didn't have an Australian yet. And and I had this amazing opportunity to move to Harvard from the University of Western Australia and learn about computational neuroscience, which at the time, you know, Emery was building that field. It barely was a field. And all of the work that he was, you know, that he was doing was just so important. So when I moved to the States, interestingly, you know, Emery said, come out for 6 months. You can audit my course on computational neuroscience. You can publish some papers with a few of, you know, the postdocs in my lab, and then you can go back to Australia. Don't worry about it. But then 6 months turned into 12 months and we kept publishing, and then 12 months turned into 24 months. And then I said, hey, I want to move to New York, and still here.
That's awesome. David, when you were 18 months old, if I have the story correct, you know, you had a seizure that left you essentially paralyzed, or at least with the diagnosis of being paralyzed on your left side. And if I recall from the stories that I've heard online, your parents decided that wasn't who you're going to be. And they put all your toys on the left side, and they made sure that your siblings would, you know, play rough with you and just, like, you know, hopefully rehab back to full capacity. In reality, it sounds like you were incredibly lucky to have such supportive parents who engaged you in your rehabilitation. Curious, how do you help patients who might not have that type of support at home?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that that's something that we're always striving for. I want to start off by saying, you know, I think that I'm incredibly lucky in a lot of ways. You know, I think that the doctors definitely got it wrong in this case, saying to my parents that I wouldn't walk again and I wouldn't regain function. I don't mean to put out there that everyone's neurological deficit can be solved by telling their siblings to play rough with them and putting a few things on one side. Although I will say that one of the most effective stroke rehab treatments to date is constraint-induced therapy, where you force use of the affected side. But what we're always striving to do in the Abilities Research Center is make better neurological care more accessible and more affordable, whilst at the same time trying to create community around the people that we work with. It's probably no coincidence that I'm married to a social neuroscientist who focuses a lot on the power of social connection and the importance of social connection in enhancing everything that we do. And that's something that we've really taken to heart in the lab as well. We always try to build a level of social connection. We have, in addition to one-on-one therapy, we have Zoom classes where people can come in and do group fitness sessions together. We have remote physiologic monitoring programs where we interact with the patients more than, you know, we have to, in order to drop the billing codes, because what we realize is that for a successful digital health solution like remote patient monitoring, what is more important than anything else is making sure that your patient understands why they're taking the measures that they're taking, understands their own data in context, and that's how you drive adherence. So when you have these, you know, soulless programs that are just like, here's a blood pressure cuff and don't call us, we'll call you, they don't work. We know that they don't work. There's you know, enormous bodies of literature saying you get adherence of 30%, and does it really keep people out of hospital? How can we tell? Yet when you actually spend time connecting with your patients, making them feel as though they have a team, making them feel as though they have someone who actually cares what happens to them, they do the monitoring requirements, and they do boost their adherence up to sort of, you know, 90% in many of the things that we've published on. And I feel like that's what makes makes the magic work here, and it allows us to have everyone feel as though they've got family working with them.
And I think one interesting thing you brought up there, David, is that you mentioned how when trying to get adoption of technology by patients, let's say remote monitoring, you have to communicate with and engage them in a certain way. So you talked about how you need to explain the why of being engaged with this technology, how it's going to benefit them. You know, you've been very successful getting adoption of new technologies and innovations at some very large organizations. So when you think about the difference in approaching the way you communicate about it, or the value proposition of adoption in technology in healthcare, how have you changed your approach when it comes to getting adoption from patients versus how do you get clinicians to adopt versus how do you convince a hospital executive to adopt? Do you have a certain framework in terms of how you approach the different stakeholders?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, when, you know, the successful technologies need to tick all the boxes. And so when we're working with patient populations, community co-design is infinitely important. It is crazy to me how many companies will start a product only speaking to the clinicians, not having a patient advisory board as part of the DNA of their company, not getting advice and information from the people that they're supposedly serving. Because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'll be, you know, as blunt as possible. If you're the head of a company that wants to make money off the backs of patients, you need to get to know the people that you're serving, and you need to, you know, actually connect with them and make sure that you understand what their needs are. So we put community co-design at the forefront of everything that we do, because if we're not solving a problem that a patient says is a problem, then we're not going to do it. Like, that's just that's it. On the clinician side, there's just, from my experience, it's just a lot of bargaining of like the win-win. So it's again, it's understanding, okay, what does this clinician in front of me want? You know, are they interested in solutions that will give them data? Are they interested in solutions? Is it just money? Like, do they just want like, show me how you're going to make me more efficient in what I'm doing? Is it reducing paperwork, epic time? You know, like, these are all the things that these aren't complicated things. These are the things that most clinicians will tell you that they want. Overarching, you know, I don't want to not state this. Overarching, most clinicians that I work with want the best for their patients, of course. So, I mean, that one seemed obvious, but I feel like I should state it as well. You know, they want evidence-based. So show me that it really does work and show me high quality data that it works. And they want to know that it's going to improve patient care. But interestingly, one of the disconnects, you know, that I often see between the patient group and the clinical group is, and I think that this needs to be explored a lot more than it currently is you can go to a clinician, you can say, here's evidence that my innovation works, here's my new health technology thing, and it definitely does work. Here's the clinical data. And often a clinician will say, great, let's implement this. This looks good. Again, no one's asked the patient, do you want to do this for this much gain in your symptoms? And often the answer is no. You know, often we hear from a lot of patients, you know, this is common in, you know, for instance, we see a lot of this in traumatic brain injury and cognitive rehabilitation. We say, here's the evidence showing that if you engage in this really intensive cognitive rehab program, these are the gains, and they're significant. But, you know, I mean, P is less than 0.05 significant. But are they meaningful? Mm-hmm. You know, and often you will have someone with a traumatic brain injury saying, well, will I be able to get back to work? Probably not. You probably won't still be able to hold down a job. So why do I care about this? Mm-hmm. And usually they should care about it. Usually it will improve other elements of their life. But if you haven't found the right way to pitch it to that audience, they're just going to say no. Like, no, I've got stuff to do. I don't want to spend 4 hours a day doing the cognitive program. Mm-hmm. That's often a challenge. Then on the administration side, it's just tell me the billing codes. tell me how much, you know, what's the windfall? And how can we streamline this? How can we programatize this? Are the billing codes too new that we're going to get audited? You know, it was, for instance, such an uphill battle with our precision recovery remote patient monitoring program to drop the initial remote physiologic monitoring billing codes because no one had used them before. Mm. And I was like, yeah, but like they're approved and other people are using them around the country, but no one had used them within the institution. And I was like, yeah, but don't we want to be first? And the billing people were like, no, we don't actually. And that was such an interesting perspective to hear from an administrator, because I was like, you know, like myself and Chris Kellner, my colleague, we're always, you know, trying to be jockeying to be first. But from the admin perspective, they're like, no, being first is terrible. You don't want to do that because it's on you if it fails. Mm. So, you know, those are all very constantly interesting perspectives.
It's so fascinating, dude. And I think one of the other concepts that it reminded me of was, even if you have great data on an intervention in a controlled setting, when you take that intervention to, let's call it, the real world, or at least let's call it the real world in a different organization, you may not get the same compliance with the implementation or the execution. So even if you have forget technology, an actual pill that's supposed to work with a certain mechanism and it creates real benefit, but if only 20% of patients are adherent to that pill, even, you won't get 100% of the benefit. And so definitely the implementation piece beyond the data makes a huge difference. That's where all your feedback around how do you get actual adoption and engagement from both patients and providers is so important. Alan found this great story about how when you create your lab at Sinai, where I believe it was Dr. Dennis Charney, the dean of the Icahn School of Medicine, apparently asked you to pitch him an idea that would make him uncomfortable. And you said you'd like to run a lab that doesn't pursue grants for research. It seems that you've always been keen on focusing on the clinical application and not just doing research for the sake of doing research. Curious, like, what's your opinion on, you know, the extent to which relying on research funding maybe restricts innovation, and maybe does it stifle certain types of clinical progress? And maybe there's certain situations where it's better or worse. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, when I had that interview with Dennis, he was he started off by telling me how amazing the health system is, and how much it's grown, and how high ranking it is, and how many amazing NIH researchers and so on and so forth. And he ended with telling me that we need to innovate faster or we're going to be left behind. And he acknowledged to me that, you know, in his opinion, we couldn't get there just with NIH funding. And the reason for that is really simple, because NIH and other large government-sponsored funding agencies, they fund incremental science. And that there is nothing wrong with incremental science. I have sort of reneged on my uncomfortable idea for Dr. Charney, in that I do have some NIH funding for some projects. It's just that, first of all, they're never the projects I'm excited about. Second, they move at a snail's pace, but they are important. They're answering certain important questions that we want to answer, but they're never the projects that go from finishing a clinical trial to implementing a new therapy that is valuable. It's so rare that that happens in NIH research. And the problem, from my opinion, is that the only reason we've placed a premium on NIH research is because this is how we rank our medical schools. This is how we rank our institutions. How much of the NIH pot are you bringing in? And so then everyone's chasing that money just because we're being told from above, well, this affects our rankings. You got to do it. Otherwise, we're not going to be a top 10 school anymore. I'm also sympathetic to that. That's important, you know. But the challenge that we face with that is it's pushing science in the wrong direction, because the NIH is necessarily risk averse. They will fund risk-averse research because it's government money, and you've got to really, really, really be sure that this is going to work out, you know, when you're using government money. Whereas when you get when you're working with industry, they'll just throw money at a moonshot idea, because if it works out, and if they fail fast, well, no worries, it was a good idea, we'll on to the next idea. And I'm not saying that all medical research should be that way. I'm just saying that right now, there's like two other places in the country that do what we do. There's far more than $300 billion a year right now being invested in health technology ventures. All of those health technology ventures need clinical research to proceed as a company. And the annual budget of the NIH is like $30 billion. So I'm kind of shocked that no one's seen this disparity and is chasing the $300 billion versus the $30 billion, other than me and, you know, one group at Shirley Ryan and, you know, another group out in New Jersey. You know, like there's a handful of places doing this and everyone else is chasing the prestigious money. I'm kind of like saying, hey, I don't care about the prestigious money. I just want to chase the funding that will get the best treatments into the hands of my patients.
I have a thought I'd love to get your take on that's related, David. So I think one of the challenges I've seen with, using research funding for new innovations or healthcare technologies has been that sometimes I think it can create almost a false sense of real demand for a solution or a real business case. So for example, you know, in my experience, I mean, I'll be honest, like you can get a research grant to study almost anything that's in healthcare technology. It's a very hot topic to be in right now. But then if you took that same innovation to, let's say, the administrators of a health system, they might have said, well, actually, no, that's not compelling enough for us to actually operationalize this. But for research, sure, someone's going to fund this because you can come up with an interesting clinical or academic research question. And so I've seen a lot of innovations produce great research, but then never get actually operationalized after the research study is over. So there's some gap there. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on, is that a real problem? Should we be okay with that? Or should there be maybe a higher bar for what gets funded and for solutions that eventually should ideally be operationalized in terms of what we choose to fund?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on with that. Idea. I think that last paragraph of everyone's specific aims page that they send out to the NIH that tells you in the future, if we complete this grant, this is what might be possible. That has wasted so much money with lies, you know, of the eventual plan to translate some of this untranslatable, you know, singular knowledge for the sake of knowledge research into something that will help patients when in many, many cases, it's just, you're 100% correct. If you go to a practical clinician and you say, will this help? You don't get there. And from my experience, the piece of that really brought that sharply into focus for me was my final postdoc at NYU, where I was working in a brain computer interface lab. And I was, you know, it was a DARPA funded project. And I was, you know, working with a team. I was the only clinician on the team. Everyone else was engineers. And when we were approaching the end of the project, you know, the principal investigator, the experiments were going well, he dances into the room and he says, we've just cured paralysis. And I don't think you could have shocked me more in that moment. Because he generated so much excitement around the lab that we'd finished the project and this was, you know, such a big step in curing paralysis. And the clinician in the room, I was like, you have put, we're not there. This ain't it. You know, like you put a wildly impractical implant into a non-human primate and gotten it to get halfway decent control of a virtual prosthesis. This really tells me that there is a huge disconnect in what a lot of the basic scientists are doing, thinking that they're solving a problem, and what is actually a clinically viable solution. And, you know, and there's a big, big gap between it. And so, you know, point in fact, on that project, that was $5 million of DARPA money. And we got like two, maybe three publications out of it in middle tier journals. And then the project got mothballed. Like, who's that helping? And you know, a lot of these grants just go to the people who know how to write them. You know the program officer, you know the ins and outs of the grantsmanship, and you know the secret code to get your stuff published. One of the first talks I went to on how to win an NIH grant when I was an assistant professor at Cornell was this guy who was like the in his field, he was an oncology researcher, and he was like had won the most NIH dollars for his field, you know, at some point over some period of time, and then he sold out and became a consultant teaching academics how to write NIH grants, which is great gig. I mean, good
that's the bigger business apparently.
And his opening line, which almost made me quit science, was like, never, ever, ever write into an NIH grant, no matter how good your data are, no matter how perfect. Never tell someone in an NIH grant that you're going to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are being peer reviewed. Everyone reviewing your grant has a vested interest in solving that problem. And if you prove to them you can solve a problem, you've created competition. And I was just like, oh my God, this is the system. Okay.
Wow. You
know, I'm pretty horrified.
Wow. Yeah, it's incredibly competitive as a system. One thing that I really admire about Mount Sinai is this culture of innovation that's been fostered over there. I think you once shared that, you know, if you don't have support from leadership, then innovation is not possible. You just can't have innovation in that case. And I, you know, as we're talking, it's evident that there's so many researchers and so many clinicians out there that are facing challenges on getting things off the ground and actually getting started with innovation. Maybe it's because of, you know, competition, but maybe there's some other reasons. Maybe the leadership's not behind the idea of innovation. So I'm curious, what are like one or two best practices that you have to get leadership bought into the idea of a new innovation?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's such a challenging environment in a big academic medical center to be taken seriously as an innovator. I think that's, you know, one of the things that is a big challenge, and that's where leadership becomes important. So I'm so fortunate that my direct boss, and he's the chair of our department, Joe Herrera, you know, he knows what he hired me for. He understood the assignment, right? Like he hires other people for other things, and he hired me for innovation. And so when I say, hey, I need backup, he's just like there with the machete, going after the red tape and saying, just move out the way and let this innovation happen. Whereas, you know, with other investigators, he doesn't feel the need to do that because they're on more of a, you know, traditional track. And similarly, you know, what I've been really fortunate about is Dean Charney has been the same. You know, when I say, look, we really got to do something, if I'm saying it and I rarely say it to him, you know, he listens and he opens doors and he makes sure that stuff happens. And that is really, really important for an innovator that is, you know, coming in at a low level faculty level, trying to champion change within a large institution. And I think that a lot of large institutions don't recognize their innovators. They're incredibly compliance oriented rather than being mission oriented. Yeah. So they say, well, you know, we'd love to let you innovate, but you need to fill out this form and this form and this form. And, you know, just drown you in a paperwork storm and off you go. And the best thing an organization can do to promote innovation is, you know, identify the people who are the innovators, understand where they can relax some of the compliance and focus on mission. So understand, you know, these people are trying to improve patient lives. And so therefore, you know, we're going to say, maybe our compliance people don't know everything. We're gonna loosen the bonds and let them actually chase after improving quality of life or quality of care and so on and so forth, because that's the biggest tension I see in big organizations always. You've got the clinicians who are saying, or the researchers who are close to patients saying, we need to be doing this. This is what the patients need. But they don't get to actually make the final call. It's always like some bean counter or some, you know, lawyer that gets to say, oh, actually, I don't think that would be best, which is crazy when you think about it, you know, that that's the way it goes. And so organizations that are good at innovation understand where it's appropriate to flip that script and say, actually, lawyer, get out the way. This is important. And I think a concrete example of that was actually just during the first surge of COVID, where the hospital just dropped all compliance pretenses and said, just help. Doesn't matter, like, just go in and help, because we need the help. Build ventilators, build recharge rooms, build remote patient monitoring apps, monitor patients. Just, we need the help, get out there and help. And it was somewhat incredible. I would not want to relive those months, but it was somewhat incredible to see how the hospital, in a very self-aware way, just went, everyone who would ordinarily be blocking, get out the way, and just like, and let the clinicians go in and help. And so it really reinforced this idea of mission-oriented versus compliance-oriented, and understanding where they can be relaxed.
And I love that concept of mission oriented versus compliance oriented. And I hope after, you know, as terrible as COVID has been, maybe one of the silver linings is that a lot of these organizations, when they've finally had to be more nimble and be less compliance oriented, and saw that, you know what, we can innovate and move quickly. And you know what, the whole hospital did not fall apart. We were still able to get things done safely and securely, and good things happen. Hopefully that gives them more confidence to maybe loosen up the strings in the future. And I think one of the things that we found helpful is, you know, let's say folks in compliance or IT or legal, you know, the moment that at some point they can be involved in the innovation and then, you know, kind of, let's be honest, be kept in the loop with how it goes, that they can say, wow, like, I was actually part of bringing this in. Look at the impact it's had on patients. You know what? I'm going to feel good about supporting stuff like this in the future. I think normally they often, after legal and IT do their thing, they just get kind of, you know, forgotten about. But maybe if we include them more in the process, they'll really kind of feel empowered to be part of that innovation journey. And then they'll, you know, hopefully be more supportive. So I've seen that work. And I think if we just bring them along the journey more, that might make an impact going forward.
Yep. I totally love that. The more you can help people understand what you're trying to do. And I think that this also cycles back to what I was talking about with a lot of the incremental research versus impact-driven research, because like a lot of the times the contracts these guys are working on, it's not exciting research. It's not like, you know, it's necessary, but it's not cool. And they're like, you know, and so often the same agreement templates show up on their desk for something that actually is cool. And you're like, hey, this is, you know, like, stop blocking this, get excited about this. But they're just like, no, this is just a collaboration agreement. And we've done 1,000 of these. There's nothing special, you know, because they're just seeing the agreement. They're not seeing anything else. But the more that you can, you know, you can bring them to the work and show them the lives and say, this happened because of you, you know, like, because you set up this agreement in this way that allowed us to do this, this is, you know, this is something that was possible. I think that's really powerful. We had when we built these recharge rooms during the pandemic, these were spaces that we set up so that healthcare workers could just come and chill. Like, because one of the first things that happened when I came into the hospital to start running our remote patient monitoring program was I just sort of looked at my space and met at the Upper East Side, and I was like, we've got like 3,000 square feet here and everything's been shut down. So it's just sitting here and it's got two bathrooms. It's got a shower. It's got, you know, like it's got stuff, and we've got, you know, healthcare workers who aren't able to eat or clean themselves or, you know, calm. So we actually designed these recharge rooms. We had designed them about 6 months before COVID with this group called Studio Elsewhere. They were actually meant to be for the NBA teams, where they were meant to be rooms that they could come off the court and just have a moment to calm their physiology before they sort of went home. And maybe it would help with sleeping, maybe it would help with team bonding. But the idea was just like this room that was especially designed to just bring you down after a heightened experience. And you know, so I kind of like snuck the designers in and said, hey, let's just build this thing, you know. And there's this guy that I work with, and you know, he's like one of the environmental engineers in the hospital, and he's like my nemesis, you know. Like anytime I'm trying to do something, he's like, you trying to drill a hole in the wall? That nope, you know, $5,000 for that hole in the wall. It's like, and we've got to bring a, you know, union guy in to drill it. And he caught wind of something going on in my lab, and so he shows up and he saw it, and he saw these healthcare workers just destroyed, but actually getting a chance to have a rest before pulling all their PPE back on and getting back into the fray. And he got really emotional, and then he was just like, we've got to build more of these, you know. And wow. He started getting involved in, you know, in the experience, and he wanted to be a part of it. And you know, and now he's an ally, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's like anything I need, I contact him and he's like on it, you know, because he gets it and he was connected to it.
Yeah, that's great. I, you know, during COVID, David, you really did kind of turn into Mother Teresa. So like the recharge rooms were one part, but then like you mentioned, you adopted the post-stroke app to coordinate, you know, triaging of patients with COVID. You directed them to education online. You even put together like infographics on how to actually access the materials and the resources. I think I even read like you drove to patients' houses to drop off scales and blood pressure cuffs and all these things, just taking it on yourself to do what needed to be done. So first of all, just major kudos to you on all of that. It's absolutely amazing. My question that I have is, in your view from these past 2 years, you know, it's illustrated a lot of ways in which we can use technology to reconnect with humans and patient-centered care. But I'm curious to get your take on, you know, how can we actually use technology to rehumanize the experience that patients have?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the central piece to the integration of technology into healthcare, is that anyone who is trying to use it to cut a corner or save a buck is going to ultimately fail, because that's not what the users want. And anyone who uses it to increase the humanity of care delivery is going to win. And we see this over and over again, you get no, you know, you just get no adherence, and you get no buy-in from people, from technological solutions and health tech solutions that are just soullessly saying, you know, like, enter this value into an app or put this sensor on you and off you go. Anything that builds a community, anything that builds a relationship between, a patient and a provider, these are the things that constantly win. And this is how we need to view technology in healthcare. We need to view it as something that we keep getting told that technology is going to increased distance between the patient and the doctor. And every time we apply technology in a way that closes the distance between those two, that's when you see the technology actually take off and win. Now, obviously, we need to be really careful about making sure that these innovations are shared in an equitable way. So I think it's really important to make sure that you don't end up with like, hey, see, all the millennials are doing great. Meanwhile, low SES, older adults, people who don't have access to things are being left out, which is why, you know, like some of the things that I get very vocal about is, you know, why does it have to be a Bluetooth blood pressure cuff that takes your blood pressure with remote patient monitoring? It's infinitely more complex for an older adult to use. Many people who don't have smartphones, you know, won't be able to use something like that. So we need to always be conscious about accessibility as we're building out the technology, because you don't want to like, you don't want to measure success by how many people you've let down. But globally speaking, you know, people will choose health solutions that increase the humanity of healthcare, not decrease it.
Yeah, I love that. You know, David, I feel like you're the perfect person to talk to about new and emerging technologies. You've really been around so many different technologies that have come out in the last 10 years. And right now there is this explosion of patient-facing technologies. There's digital patient engagement. So engaging patients digitally pre and post-surgery, let's say, monitoring symptoms. There's 3D printed limbs that I've heard you've had experience with, concussion detection sensors, and even video game therapy specifically designed for brain development and recovery. What is a technology that you're most excited about today?
Oh, well, you know, you guys heard about my love of brain computer interfaces, my love hate of brain computer interfaces. So one of the technologies that I'm working with that I'm super excited about is we're working with a company called Synchron. They have a brain computer interface technology that is still an invasive implant, but it's minimally invasive. So rather than opening the skull and pushing a device into the brain and requiring open brain surgery to use a technology, this device is a tiny little stent. It enters the body through the jugular vein, gets into a large vessel in the head called the superior sagittal sinus, and you place the stent right by the motor cortex in the brain, which is the area that controls voluntary movement. The stent will heal into the blood vessel, and from the vantage point of the blood vessel, it can record brain activity that can be used to control a computer. So we've gone down a long road with Stentrode and Synchron to get the technology to a point where it's FDA approved and we're ready to do our first in-human implant here in the United States. So in the next couple of months, we plan to implant our first patient, which will be an individual with ALS who's completely paralyzed. And the goal will be to train that individual to gain complete independent home use control of a computer using thought alone.
Wow. Is that Don? There is an ALS patient. I think his name is Don, the individual. There was another device that you had pioneered. Oh, this was years ago, I think.
No, that was years ago. So that was actually work we did with No Impossible around eye tracking technology. Mm. So at the time, we were just trying to make cheaper, you know, there was eye tracking technology that could allow severely disabled individuals to control a computer, but they cost about $40,000.
Wow.
And then there was a gaming version of the same technology, which was basically the same stuff, but it was $120, but it was really hard to integrate into any sort of software system. So back then we created a system for Don that allowed him to communicate independently with his wife using eye tracking technology. interestingly, you know, a wonderful organization called Team Gleason, which is, you know, founded after a former NFL player who has gone on to get ALS, and they partnered with Microsoft and made that style of solution permanent. So now if you have a Windows 10 machine, it will integrate accessibility capabilities with that $120 wow. piece of equipment. So you don't need to pay $40,000 for a medical device, mm-hmm. Which insurance often doesn't pay for. This technology is brand new. That, you know, no one's really interacted with it in the United States. The company themselves have run a successful clinical trial implanting 4 patients in Australia. And each of the 4 patients have achieved independent home use of the technology, which is super impressive, mm-hmm. because with invasive BCIs, for the most part, in the last 20 years, there's not been many that have achieved independent home use. You can use them well in the clinic, and you'll often see a news story about someone moving a robotic arm mm-hmm. around and giving themselves a drink, but to date, that hasn't been carried through to the home. It only works in the lab. So this, I think, is a very, you know, I get pretty giddy about it, because it's an exciting project for the, you know, the future of severe paralysis. And yeah, I can't wait to see where it goes.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. David, we're going to flip over to what we have. It's called the Fast 5 Lightning Round. This is basically just okay. 5 questions to get to know you better for our audience. Question 1 that we have: what is your favorite book or book you've gifted the most?
Oh, God. you know, I'm going to say I'm blanking on the guy's name. Oh shit! You know, there's a couple. So can I give you 2 at least?
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Because I think that, you know, for a lot of what we do, team is so important. Teamwork is important. You know, I don't want anyone to think that anything I'm saying on this is by any means me. You know, like, even I kind of cringed, Alan, when you were talking about like that. I was like Mother Teresa, because I was doing all of those things, but my whole team was doing all of those things. You know, we're a really well bonded group, and we work hard on all our projects. So I love The Culture Code by Dan Coyle. I think it's something that people should read. I've given it away a lot. On the technology innovation side, there's a book called Where Good Ideas Come From, and it really walks you through, you know, innovation processes. And what I like about the book is that it really does a good job of selling to people that innovation is a process, and it's repeatable. Because I think a lot of people just think, oh, they went for a moonshot and they got lucky, and that's just not how it is. And so walking people through that process in a very concrete way with good evidence for how it works is, I think, really important to get people in a mindset that teaches them that innovation is possible for everyone. You just need to know where the opportunities are.
I love that. Question 2, how has an apparent failure set you up for greater success?
I would say the NYU story that I told was pretty, to me, that was like a, you know, that was a pretty big failure. I feel like we, you know, I guess I wasn't explicit enough about that, but I felt that after the, you know, 4 years of a DARPA project, we had achieved nothing. And I was just sort of like very, very daunted at what was next for me scientifically. But then I sort of pushed into, okay, well, you know, complaining about it is one thing, but what are you going to do about it? And then I started thinking about building a space like this.
I love that. Question 3, this one's different. Would you rather have super strength, super speed, or the ability to read people's minds?
Oh, man. read people's minds.
Okay, yeah. Question 4, what's something in healthcare you believe that others might find insane?
other than sticking brain implants into people.
That's funny.
So other than that, oh God, yeah, just step outside, like exoskeletal robots. Yeah, I mean, everything I get to work with on a daily basis is pretty insane. Vagus, you know, implanted vagus nerve stimulators.
Wow.
You know, yeah, lots of crazy cool things going on.
That's awesome. Yeah. Last question that we have, David. This is a pandemic lockdown related question. What is one hobby or activity you've gotten into since the beginning of the pandemic?
Oh yeah, this is super like embarrassing, but well, I don't know if it's embarrassing, but it's weird. Pasta making. I got really like disturbingly into pasta making, learning how to make all sorts of different pastas, becoming very snobby about anyone who uses one of those hand cranking things.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just, you know, so amateur. You
yeah, you got to go with the chopstick and roll, and yeah, that's great.
So David, you're saying there's no computer brain interface at all involved with this pasta making. Yeah. You are doing it the old fashioned way.
It's all me, exactly.
That's amazing. That's great. David, looking at the time, just want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. There's a ton of wisdom that you have, and you really did share a lot of that with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to share these insights with us, and hopefully our audience can take some learnings away as well. I'm really excited to hear more about these innovative technologies that you're working on, so I'll definitely keep an eye out for that. But again, just thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Oh, no worries. This was a great chat. Thank you.
Amazing. Awesome. Thank you, David.